Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's edition of ISGP's The Forum, where science comes to socialize. I'm Cleo.
I'm Barbara.
And this is Aubrey. Don't forget that the Institute on Science for Global Policy loves to hear all of your comments, so tweet us at ISGPForum with the hashtag ISGPForum.
You can also join the conversation on our Facebook page, which can be found by searching ISGP's The Forum. Or visit the ISGP website at scienceforglobalpolicy.org.
Today, we're all going to don our food scientist hats as we discuss our current food system and the agricultural systems of developing regions, such as sub-Saharan Africa.
While doing so, we'll also cover the growing problem of food waste and its many impacts on society.
And also how technical innovations in the post-harvest process may be the secret to achieving food security.
All of this comes from the paper Dr. Linus O'Pair presented at our Verona, Italy FSSD conference, Focus on Technologies and Innovations, on April 14th through 17th in 2013, and the debate it thus inspired. Just as a refresher, FSSD stands for Food Safety, Security, and Defense. So a food conference in Italy? Sounds quite fitting.
Most definitely. And Dr. O'Pair appropriately titled his paper, Post-Harvest Technologies for Food Security and Safety, Linking Knowledge, Infrastructure, and Policy.
A few of our previous episodes have focused on the food system in terms of procurement and planting. But what happens after that? What happens after all the beans are planted and all the carrots are watered? Well, it turns out a whole lot of important stuff happens.
But first, let's set the stage for you. According to Dr. O'Pair, plus many other food scientists, the availability of and access to quality, nutritious, and safe foods, ones that will also meet the demands of a growing population, is one of the biggest challenges of our time.
With a projected global population swelling to 9 billion by 2050, it certainly seems like a challenge. This would require more than a 70% increase in food production in order to meet future food demands.
So, a lot of us may be wondering, what the heck are we going to do? A 70% increase is nothing to scoff at. It's like using all your available energy to run a marathon, finish, then have someone tell you you have to run 18 more miles or else millions of people will die.
Well, I would have maybe gone with an example having to do with more food, but that works too. But getting to the question regarding what we're going to do about this scenario, we might also ask, is it possible for traditional agriculture to get us to this number?
Well, Dr. O'Pair thinks that in order to meet future demands, we're going to need new, smart agriculture. That is, technology that is going to help us produce more food with fewer resources, and even reduce our current amount of food loss and waste.
Which is apparently pretty exorbitant, by the way. The debaters actually focused a good deal on just this subject. It doesn't matter if we're talking about more or less affluent countries, the sheer volume of generated food waste needs to be viewed with concern.
How is food waste so prevalent? Well, perhaps the proper question here is, where is food waste particularly prevalent? The answer, quite simply, is numerous points along the food chain.
So it happens in the fields, when insects invade grain stores, while sorting and packaging, in restaurants where food is prepared in excessive amounts, really at any point in a product's life. However, a substantial amount of food seems to be wasted at the retail level, as supermarkets often discard large amounts of perfectly edible produce that just happens to be, say, overhandled.
And this overhandling could lead to bruised or otherwise ugly produce.
You know, that's not very nice of you to be picking on the innocent misshapen tomatoes, Cleo.
Hey, it's not me. This is just the cold, hard reality out there of our produce. Better we teach them young, you know?
Okay, Cleo. You go educate that produce. Back to food waste in reality. Perhaps one of the most concerning things is that since so many private businesses are involved in the food supply chain, we're really not sure how to obtain an accurate estimate of the scale of food loss.
While there's some disagreement as to whether or not, and to what extent, North American nations and other countries have quantified the scale of food waste, some of the debaters at this conference had a more positive perspective. They argued that in recent years, a considerable amount of research in North America has been devoted to quantifying and analyzing food waste.
For what end are we doing all this quantifying? How do these numbers even help us?
Well, currently, the evidence suggests that the amount of losses and waste varies widely. Nonetheless, with all this quantifying, it's now possible to determine the financial and environmental impacts of food waste.
We should note that according to Dr. Opara, improving the accuracy and reliability of, as well as the access to, such data should be given urgent priority by national and regional policymakers.
All right, this definitely makes sense, but what else is being done or planned to be done about food waste? Once we have these numbers, what do we do?
Well, the debaters seem to agree that the most effective method to decrease food waste was through a system of incentives. Coming to mind is maybe awarding companies somehow for lowering monthly levels of food waste. Through these incentives, we can work towards minimizing food waste along the various stages of the production and supply chain.
Not to pull us all completely off the thought train of food waste, but the waste itself isn't the only issue here. In order to fully meet the challenge of food waste and post-harvest losses, we need to think about the concepts of producing food for oneself versus producing food for the masses.
In this conversation of food security, in other words, we also have to address the sometimes unclear issues of self-sufficiency and to determine if addressing them could aid in creating more efficient and functioning food systems.
And these issues indeed become very unclear when it comes to less affluent countries, such as those in sub-Saharan Africa, which, by the way, is an area the debaters really focused on, and one we'll be discussing a lot with you today.
Defining self-sufficiency, let alone implementing it within communities, is a challenge in and of itself.
To some individuals, the concept of self-sufficiency implies exclusion from a global system, which can be a daunting thought, as one may imagine. Because of this, great care needs to be taken when defining the term, so that the definition considers what it means to be sufficient on a national and regional scale, as well as at the individual scale.
Okay, so I get that defining it properly is important and all, but how is this directly helping those who are food insecure?
Well, the prevailing notion is that one can meet the challenge of improving food security through the power of self-sufficiency. However, this idea was actually strongly contested by our debaters.
Yeah, so while self-sufficiency may sound nice for certain situations, widespread national food security has really only ever been achieved through the industrialization of agriculture.
Well, there goes my mental image of nice backyard gardens popping up to save the day.
Sorry about that, Barb. The debaters decided that it's inappropriate and just plain ineffective to force everyone to be a farmer. This strategy is simply not working in sub-Saharan Africa. And perhaps there's even a need to move to a for-profit rather than subsistence agriculture system.
So maybe the idea isn't getting rid of the self-sufficiency model completely, but reconceptualizing it on a more national and regional scale. Either way, the debaters were adamant that we need to begin considering methods of industrialization of food production, at least in the context of sub-Saharan Africa.
The manner in which industrialization must manifest is yet to be determined, but the debaters did see the encouragement of nationwide agriculture rather than individual level self-sufficiency as essential.
This way, those who wish to engage in agricultural production may do so, but it won't be their only choice.
All right, so historically, industrialization does seem to encourage development, but it's also classically known for bringing in a whole new set of problems to an area.
This is also true. Industrialization is certainly not without its negative impacts, making it something that needs to be handled delicately. There's concern that industrialization could result in a mass migration of people into cities to find work, resulting in more people than there are available jobs.
In this way, poverty and food insecurity would continue to exist, just in a different form. But it also turns out that while this migration and lack of jobs situation is a concern, there's no precedent for this outcome having been caused just by industrialization.
Okay. So industrialization has significant downsides and upsides. What we have to keep in mind, though, is that industrialization and development aren't going to mean much if local people aren't also engaged in the process. Communities need to be able to criticize and take action against ineffective governance that hinders food security efforts.
Okay, but we're not talking about the developed world here. The act of protesting isn't quite the same as it is in, say, America or parts of Europe. In some areas, this kind of political activity could be pretty dangerous, and in other regions, people just simply don't have time or resources for these sorts of things.
Now, this sounds like a pretty bleak situation, but it can also be viewed as an opportunity for innovation. Possible solutions could include pulling in multiple stakeholders to enable action.
What exactly do you mean by this?
Well, the debaters suggested things like university professors devoting time to educating students about governance and policy issues related to their academic topics, exploring issues related to food security, for example, beyond simply teaching about agriculture.
This engagement needs to extend past universities, though. We need to think bigger, like community groups, churches, and NGOs. These could all be potential partners in the effort to overturn poor governance that is impeding food security efforts.
But wait, don't we already have some programs and investments emanating from outside of Africa to help with these sorts of developmental problems? The Gates Foundation has funded some investments that encourage food self-sufficiency in the sub-Saharan Africa region. Even the Chinese are investing in agriculture there. Why aren't these efforts adequate?
Well, the debaters seem to think that these efforts don't really help as much as we would like to think. At best, they do little to improve food security in a sustainable manner.
And in worst cases, as we saw through some Chinese investments, these activities tend to serve the interests of the investors rather than the sub-Saharan communities. Some serious negative consequences can emerge from these unequal partnerships that have very little transparency within their agreements.
But then again, we're really not sure how popular any agreement would be if it was subjected to a more open and transparent process.
But why?
Yeah, I thought transparency was almost always a good thing.
Well, yes, you're right. Transparency is basically vital for any properly functioning organization or system. However, there do exist governments and groups that prefer to operate under conditions of less transparency so that they may take advantage of the situation. Groups such as these could potentially work against initiatives that ensure greater transparency.
I see. So I guess the next logical step is to encourage both governments and communities to better mobilize the resources needed to build food security.
That's what the debaters seem to think, too. Local efforts are possibly the only way to ensure that African interests and resources are given the priority. After all, who better to ensure the longevity and success of a project than the people who most directly depend on it? But we can't forget how important it is for all of this to be done in an ecologically sustainable manner.
And also with governmental commitment to such efforts, at least at the beginning stages. Without this specifically, food security will remain an unachievable goal. Examples in India, China, and Vietnam have already shown that the government-led industrialization of agriculture has led to considerable improvements in national food security.
The debaters actually laid out a nice framework for policymakers to consider regarding this needed governance.
Key aims for policymakers need to be 1. Defining and understanding the role of governments in promoting food security.
2. Laying the foundations for private sector investment.
And 3, encouraging an environment in which various technologies can be deployed successfully. To achieve all of this, policymakers must possess a heightened sense of awareness in regards to their responsibilities.
Much like Spider-Man's spidey senses, but for food security, which is also now officially my new favorite superpower.
We joke, but this is actually such an important aspect of the process. It's not uncommon for commitments to be made on the part of the government, but actually following through? Well, that's a whole other story.
Oftentimes, the government will agree to a project without providing the sufficient commitment needed to ensure actual enactment. Until governance is strengthened, technologies will not be used to their full potential.
Don't forget about the private sector, though, as they also have a crucial role to play in enhancing food security in sub-Saharan Africa. However, there's still work to be done regarding exactly when this role needs to be played.
It was argued that private sector contributions are valuable only once governments have laid the groundwork,
such as the construction of railways and airports,
and are in position to assist with private sector development, such as the case in Vietnam and Cambodia.
Others, however, felt that the private sector could play a role independent of the government. In some cases, both the private sector and individual farmers have benefited in times when governance structures haven't been sound.
But we also have to have local systems working collaboratively with one another, or else international efforts will most likely find limited success.
So these efforts have to be sustainable, have governmental aid, and be community supported. Sounds like sub-Saharan Africa has a lot to pull together.
Well, reaching this goal of food security is certainly no easy task, but without these components, especially the community infrastructure, international businesses will remain reluctant to invest in the area. Without this investment for aid, it's anyone's guess as to where monetary support will come from.
And we really can't stress enough here how important it is to strengthen local infrastructure and foster committed local leadership.
Improvements in agricultural infrastructure must be integrated into a wider social development agenda in order to be successful. This social development could take the form of investing in agricultural universities, such as what happened in India in the 1960s and 70s. These actions led to India becoming one of the largest producers of tractors in the world.
It should be noted that such developments are only likely to take root if agriculture is seen as a crucial part of a region's growth.
So, what do you, our listeners, think? What will it take for agriculture to become a policy priority?
How do you think the average consumer plays into the equation of our initial topic of the day, food waste? Is it possible to make a difference without government mandates?
How will developing regions, like sub-Saharan Africa, be able to tackle these issues when so few have set a good example?
Our debaters thought industrialization could solve food insecurity, but do you? Are there potential negative outcomes that could outweigh the benefits?
Log on to Twitter or Facebook to let us know your answers to these or any other questions. You can find us at ISGP Forum with hashtag ISGP Forum, or by looking up ISGP's The Forum on Facebook. Or visit the ISGP website at scienceforglobalpolicy.org.
And don't be shy. This is your turn to have your opinions heard. What would you have added to the conversation if you were at the Institute on Science for Global Policy's debate table?
Well, we look forward to talking with you all on social media soon. That's all we have for today, so thanks for socializing with science. We'll catch you next time right here on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.